So with a topic title like this, I am assuming either you are curious about attaining moksha, or perhaps you want to attain moksha, or perhaps you want to see whether this knowledge aligns with what you already know. All right, so you can have additional reasons, and that is perfectly fine. Because this particular class is an introductory one, one that allows people to understand what moksha is and how to possibly attain it. In fact, the word attain is itself an improper word, to be very honest, and we will see that in the classes to come as well. But I would take this title to be provisionally correct until we correct it a little later, all right, in the class. So the purpose of the class. So before if this class has been organized, there should be a purpose. Why should we organize a class like this one, especially with a very captivating title like How to Attain Moksha? All right, so why? So I like to share this particular verse that you see on the screen, which is from the Yoga Vasishta. Very beautiful verse. Ajnasya ardha prabuddhasya sarvam brahmeti yovadet mahanaraka jaleshu satena viniyojitaha. Look at the translation. He who preaches to the ignorant and the half-learned that everything is Brahman verily entangles him in a mesh of horrible hells. I encountered this particular verse more than a decade ago. And this verse clearly tells us that the knowledge about everything being Brahman, which is equal to attaining moksha, can actually make people unhappy. Interesting as it may sound, because many people think that this knowledge can make you happy, which I'm going to talk more about in the sessions to come. However, that is not the case. There is a chance that people may live their life as if they are in horrible hells if this knowledge has not been, if this knowledge was taught to someone who is perhaps not prepared. And that is one of the reasons why we at the Hindu Hub wanted to conduct this class. And there will be a series of classes on the topic of moksha in the next year as well. But it is not that the knowledge is a problem. The knowledge is technically a lifesaver, to be very honest. However, to learn this knowledge would require someone to be prepared. And that preparation is something that I will be also unfolding in the sessions to come. So this is a very, I would like to start this class with a focus on this particular beautiful verse, which tells us something very interesting. Perhaps we have not even encountered or even aware of a doctrine like this one, which is the possibility of knowledge about Brahman or moksha, which can actually make people unhappy. So this is something very interesting, which I believe some of you may not know, and those of you who may know, this is just a confirmation. So the purpose of this class. The first thing, basically what we are trying to do is to remove confusion and gain clarity. All right, so we want to remove the confusion surrounding the subject of moksha and thereby also gain clarity with regard to that. So a couple of questions we will discuss in this series of classes. What is moksha? All right, which we will be doing today. And what is the means to it and the process? All right, we are going to look at that as well. How to develop competence. That means if you happen to be seeking moksha, now how can you make yourself competent or eligible for you to be successful in the in attaining the goal that you have set yourself for? And then who is competent to teach, meaning that the guru, the person who teaches this topic of moksha, how is he or she competent? We're going to look at that. And what is the source of this knowledge that delivers the result, which is basically moksha? Where does it come from? We're going to look at that. And then we are going to also discuss what is the role of bhakti and meditation, dhyana, which is very much associated with a lot of topics or discourses around moksha. We're going to look at that. All right, so these are the broad questions. All right, there are many sub questions in, I think, under each of these questions. However, these are the broad questions that we are going to answer in this class as well as the classes and sessions to come. So how would this benefit you? All right, by knowing all of this, how could it possibly benefit you? Let's look at that. All right, we are in a world where we want to know, how does anything benefit us, right? What's in it for me? So let's answer that question as well. So how does it benefit me? Now, to know what moksha is, which is a very important question, because it is a very popular term. If you Googled moksha, you will see thousands of websites perhaps trying to describe what moksha is. So therefore, it is good to know what it is. To also to see if I am ready to seek moksha, which is a very important question. And having taught this subject for several years, and one of the things that I've noticed is many people want to seek moksha, but actually they do not know whether they are ready or not. So let me give you an example. Now, sometimes, you know, we are using our mobile phones, all right, our smartphones, and you're talking to someone. And then you tell the other person, you know what, I'm not able to hear you. Can you move somewhere? Can you move to another spot so that I can hear you clearly? And then you realize that the other person is moving to different spots and then different parts of their home or different parts of their place, and yet you cannot hear them. And the reason why you cannot hear them is not because of them, because you are in the wrong spot. You have to move your location to somewhere where your signal is strong. So sometimes we think that we are ready to seek moksha, but actually that is not. Actually, we are not ready. And because we are not ready, we think that the knowledge doesn't work. We think that the teacher is wrong, or we think the Shastra is wrong. Shastra here means the text that reveal the wisdom. They are wrong. But sometimes the problem is not with the teacher. The problem is not with the Shastra. The problem is within me. Now, I am not saying the teacher has no problems. I'm not saying the Shastra that possibly may not be clear, maybe completely clear, perhaps. But what I'm saying is there is a possibility that the problem is within me and the readiness is not there. And that's the reason why it is not working. That's why I gave you the smartphone example. Actually, it's not the smartphone of the other person. It's your phone. You need to move your place. And if you get to the right place, perhaps there would be clarity. And then the third benefit, to know why I'm not experiencing it even after learning it from a teacher. There are many, maybe a few of you in the room today, you have learned this from a teacher. And somehow you feel that you are not experiencing it, which is very, very justified. And it is a very, very good question as well. So that is also a benefit in that sense, to know why is it that I'm not seeing it. All right, so we'll talk about that. And then lastly, to be able to explain to others, which is also very important. You may not be seeking it, but yet sometimes there could be others who are wanting this as a goal. So to be able to articulate this, to explain this to another person is also a great benefit. So just as anyone, I think anyone should know about this knowledge. So that's why this class is meant for everyone. We did not say that you need to usually in the Vedanta classes or topics of moksha, we usually do a proper intake. A proper intake is basically to discuss with a student and spend some time in a conversation to understand their readiness. And then we would normally admit the person into a class. Because you know why? Because we do not want that person to be living a life as if they are in a horrible hell. That's the reason. Now, that's why we need to have this conversation before you enter a class about moksha. And one of the reasons why we are recording this class, so that this class is always available for someone who wants to take this path. In no way am I dissuading you from taking this path. No way am I persuading you to take this path. All that we want to know, all that you want to do in this class is to make you fully aware whether you are ready for this, or with how you can make yourself ready for this, or perhaps just understand what it is. All right, so these are the benefits that we are possible to gain. Now, the content of this series of classes is based on the Anubandha Chatushtaya. Some of you would have heard this phrase. It's basically the fourfold considerations when you unfold any body of knowledge. So the first one is called Prayojana, which is purpose. So whenever we conduct a class, there is a purpose behind it. So what is the purpose of this particular series of classes? basically, these are the two things that we're going to talk about in terms of purpose: defining and describing moksha, and also to discover the myths and conceptions about moksha. So this is the purpose. Adhikari, who is the competent person who can learn this topic, this particular subject that we're going to talk about? So who is the competent person? So basically, in this area, we're going to learn how can we make oneself competent? And also to discover the qualification of the guru, which is also very important. All right, so that's what we're going to look at: the adhikari of the competent teacher and the competent student. All right, we're going to talk about that. And thirdly, we're going to talk about the vishaya, which is subject. Now, subject is basically the teaching. What is the teaching that is presented or taught in when somebody wants to attain moksha? And then we're also going to talk about or discuss the scriptures that teach moksha. We need to talk about that as well. And then lastly, it's called sambandha, which is the connection, especially between the competent person and the purpose. Now, how are we going to do it? We're going to look at the process that makes an eligible person or a competent person attain moksha. And we're also going to talk about the role of bhakti in this process, as well as what is the role of meditation, which are two big topics that are usually often associated with moksha. All right, so this is basically the broad outline of the 10 classes or sessions that we're going to have. All right, so with that, now, what are the non-intentions? Now, what do I mean by non-intentions? Now, non-intentions are also very important, because there could be some ulterior motive behind why I'm conducting this class or why this particular series of classes are being conducted. So we also need to look at what is it that we're not intending. All right, so I also want to share this with you very clearly so that we know why we're doing what we are doing. So what are the non-intentions? Now, this class is conducted on the premise of valuing the pluralism within Sanatana Dharma. What do I mean by valuing the pluralism? Now, Sanatana Dharma, or what we call popularly today as Hinduism, is not just one philosophy. There are many, many philosophies. There is bhakti traditions, there are knowledge traditions, jnana traditions, there are yoga traditions. So there are many traditions in there. Some of you may know there is also a very, very ancient philosophies like yoga, Purva Mimamsa, and Vaisheshika, etc., the many darshanas. And there are also modern and also medieval sampradayas like bhakti traditions, Vaishnava traditions, Shaiva traditions, Shakta traditions, Ganapatya traditions. Now, all of these traditions are within Sanatana Dharma. So this class is not in any way to prove the other sampradayas or traditions wrong. All right, so this, I want to be very clear about that. In fact, the uniqueness of Sanatana Dharma, it is like a huge banyan tree with all of these traditions in there. And each one of us gravitate towards one of these traditions based on your own karma or disposition. Or sometimes I say, it is not what you choose, it is Bhagavan who chooses. So therefore, I'm not in any way trying to render any of these traditions false or wrong or invalid. All right, so I'm conducting this class on the premise that this pluralism is inherent and it's valid. All right, however, what I'm presenting is the Vedantic perspective, and I'm going to share a little more what this perspective is. In no way am I also challenging or replacing the learning from your guru or tradition that you may belong to. That is not the purpose. All right, so maybe some of the things that I say may appear as if I'm challenging you, or maybe even trying to replace and dispute the learning that you've had. So when that happens, please bear in mind that your guru is the person that you should actually listen to. Now, your guru's teachings are final, not mine. All right, keep that in your mind. If you happen to belong to a tradition, then your tradition actually is the what I call as the supreme authority in terms of what you want to take away in your life. So again, if you feel that I'm challenging or replacing the learning from your guru or your tradition, please bear in mind that that is not the purpose. All right, stick to your what you have learned and stick to the tradition that you come from. So therefore, what am I doing, right? So I am confining and appreciating moksha through the Upanishads. So keyword here is Upanishads. Then second keyword is as interpreted by Adi Shankara. So this is very important. So I am now sharing with you that what I'm sharing in these series of classes is basically what the Upanishads teach through the eyes of a very, very venerable teacher. Many of us may know who this teacher is, which is Adi Shankara, which is called the Advaita Vedanta Sampradaya. All right, the Advaita Vedanta tradition. So that is the lenses that I'm using, trying to get behind those lenses and presenting this. So now, what is my sources of knowledge? So because I'm going to present this topic, I need to also identify, where are my sources? Where am I depending on? When I share all the contents and topics that I'm going to share in the next few sessions. So I'm going to use a very, very important method that is unfolded by Swami Vidyaranya in his Panchadashi. So whenever you see a slide like this one, on the bottom right, you see a name of the text and the number. What it means is that I'm quoting a text and the verse number. So whenever you see 6.56, it means that chapter 6, verse 56. All right, so that's how you're going to interpret it. So in the Panchadashi, Swami Vidyaranya gives a very nice methodology, which is called Shruti Yukti Anubhava. So the sources through which I'm going to present, number one, is Shruti, meaning that I'm going to use the Veda. In this case, primarily the Upanishads. So what am I going to do? I'm going to use Prasthanatraya. Prasthanatraya means the threefold foundations or the threefold sources, which is basically for Advaita Vedanta or Advaita or Vedanta, we use these three sources as the authority. All right. So the first one is Upanishads, although I will be confining myself to what we call as the principal Upanishads. So principal Upanishads, generally some people say there are only 10, some of them say there are 13, and some of them say that there are 16, etc. So primarily it's the 10 to 16, that many. So sometimes in Sanskrit, it is called Mukhya Upanishad. Mukhya Upanishad means principal Upanishad. So I will primarily use those Upanishads on which Adi Shankara has commented. But sometimes I may also use other Upanishads if it serves our purpose to explain, to organize. So I will also use Brahma Sutra of attributed to sage Vyasa and also Badarayana sometimes. So I will also use Brahma Sutra as well as the commentaries on it by Adi Shankara. And I will also use Bhagavad Gita with Adi Shankara's commentary as well. And over and above that, sometimes I will also use traditional texts like this one, Panchadashi. And these traditional texts could be Shankara's works, and it could be pre and post Shankara. What do I mean by pre and post Shankara? Sometimes I may use works before Shankara. If there are any Advaita Vedanta works before Shankara, I will use that. Sometimes I may use works after Shankara, like this one. Panchadashi is after Shankara. So I will use post Shankara works. So that's what I mean by pre and post. And of course, other Vedanta texts as well. So this is Shruti, all right, which is basically texts. Next is Yukti, logic and reasoning. So I would also use logic and reasoning to explain whatever that we are looking at in this class. But I would only use the logic and reasoning such that it aligns with the Shruti. This is very key. All right, so the logic and reasoning, they must align with what the Shastra says. So that is how I'll be conducting my logic and reasoning. Lastly, experience. All right, so what is it that we are experiencing? All right, so that is also taken into account. So there is a kind of a what you call popular method people use. People tend to always go to experience first, right? It's a very common thing, all right? Every time people, you ask someone, you know, oh, have you experienced it? So in Advaita Vedanta, somehow we do not depend too much on experience, or we don't start with experience. Do you know why? Because when you look at the sun, it rises in the east and sets in the west. You see the sun literally move, rising up, and then it sets in the west. But we all know the sun doesn't rise. So how can I trust my experience, right? So experience cannot be dismissed, very important thing. We cannot dismiss experience, but we should be able to process experience. So how do we process experience? So in the case of the sun rising in the east and setting in the west, how we process is through the knowledge that when you go out into the space, you realize actually it is the earth that rotates in its axis, right? It is not that the sun literally rises in the east and sets in the west. So that's called processing the experience through new knowledge. So that is where the Shruti comes. The Shruti gives you new knowledge. All right, the Shastra gives you new knowledge so that you can process your experience. And how do you process it? Using logic and reasoning, which is called Yukti. So this is how I would be very much processing whatever that we are learning in this session. Sometimes I may lean more towards Shruti. Sometimes I may lean more towards Anubhava. Sometimes I might lean towards Yukti, or sometimes all three will be there. All right, so please. So this is basically to share with you what are the sources of knowledge when we talk about the topic of moksha. Next, now we're going to enter the important topic. Etymological root means, in Sanskrit, every word has a root. So let's look at what is the root of moksha. So the word moksha here is actually a derivative. Derivative means is derived from another root. That is what is called derivative. So the root word is actually called much. Okay, the Sanskrit root word for moksha is much. For example, some of you would have heard the word dharma. So the root word of dharma is dhr. The root word of karma is kr. So the root word of moksha is much. All right. So some other roots sometimes use is also moksh. Sometimes people use the word munch. So all these roots are there for moksha. So what does the root word much literally means? Now it means basically this: to release, to loosen, or to liberate. So the word much literally means to release, to loosen, to liberate. So the question now is, what should you release yourself from? What should you loosen? What should you liberate yourself from? So a good question, right? So that's the root word, is to lose, to release, to loosen, to liberate. So what is that? So we call, basically, what are you releasing yourself from, loosening yourself from, or liberating yourself from is samsara. All right. So this is basically primarily what we are loosening ourselves or releasing ourselves from, which is samsara. So the definition of samsara is samyak sarati iti samsara. So samyak sarati means that which flows well, or that which is continuously changing. Now that is called samyak sarati. All right. So therefore, samsara literally means something that is changing all the time. Can you see this point? All right. So samsara means that which is changing all the time. So now listen to this very carefully. I would like you to lend me your ears at this point. Change. Is change a problem? And it's a good question, right? Is change really a problem? But remember, when you change your home to a smaller, from a smaller home to a bigger home, no, you don't have a problem. When you change your smartphone, you know, from iPhone 6 to maybe iPhone 10 or whatever, that's not a problem. So change is usually not a problem. So therefore, here is a key point that we need to see. So samsara is not a problem for everyone. So because change is not a problem for everyone. However, change becomes a problem to someone who is tired of change. Can you see that? So we need to be able to recognize that actually change is always not a problem. But there are some people who find change a problem, which is what I'm going to talk about in the next class. So these are very unique people who find that the changing world, the changing things, the changing people, the changing environment, and lastly, the changing self. Now, all of this becomes a problem. So when I say problem means, it becomes something that is adverse. We will analyze this a little later in the next class. But at this point, what we need to recognize is that change is what we are trying to overcome through moksha. And this change is something we will look at more closely in the next few classes. All right. So with that now that we know that the problem, right? So moksha is a solution, basically, and every solution tries to overcome a problem, right? There is no solution. The solution is only relative to a problem. I hope that you see this point, all right? So if you have a problem, you try to fix it. That is called a solution. So if moksha is the solution, then samsara can be called the problem. I hope you see this point, all right? So that is the problem that we're trying to solve. So when samsara is seen as a problem, then moksha is the solution. Okay, so I would like all of us to recognize this important point at this juncture. Now, with that, now let's look at the many terms for moksha that we have. So, in our shastra and in our tradition, there are many terms that are used for moksha. Now, here let's look at several words. It is not exhaustive, but certainly it gives us a glimpse into the many words. Moksha is certainly one of them. The other one is called Apavarga. Apavarga is another word that is used for moksha. Nirvana. Nirvana is another word that we use, as well as also shared with Buddhism as well. Now, Kaivalya is another word that is used for moksha. Mukti is another one. And then Nishreyasa is another one. Among all of the words, the oldest word for perhaps moksha is Nishreyasa. So Nishreyasa is the perhaps the ancient word or the most oldest word for moksha. So this is something that you find in our Shastra as well. So now we have seen the many terms that we see that can be used as synonyms for moksha. Now let us look at the types of moksha. So this is going to be very tricky, right? So there are different types of moksha, actually, to be very honest. Many of us may not know this, but it's very important for us to recognize that there are many types of moksha. So the question is, why are there many types of moksha? Because it depends on your competence. It depends on your disposition. And also depends on one important point, which I stress again. It depends on Bhagavan. It depends on Ishvara. Right? So sometimes we think that we are the one who is choosing, but actually we are not choosing anything. Because you did not choose your parents. You did not choose your childhood. And as much as many things that you think that you have chosen, in fact, you have very limited choices. A lot of things are given to you more than you having had it. Even if you think that you have earned a promotion, it is at the expense of many other factors that we can't control. And similarly, there are many things that influence us to choose the type of moksha that resonates with us. All right? So let us look at the five types of mukti that is revealed in the Muktika Upanishad. So in the chapter 1 of the Muktika Upanishad, there are five types of mukti that are revealed. Let us look at each one of them. The first one is called Salokya Mukti, the liberation that is called Salokya. The second one is called Sarupya. The third one is called Samipya. The fourth one is called Sayujya. And the fifth one is called Kaivalya. All right, so let's look at all of these five to understand why are there five types of mukti or five types of moksha. Let us look at the first one, which is Salokya. So I'm going to now take a translation from the Muktika Upanishad. So this is what Salokya Mukti is. So here it says, anybody, even though leading a wicked life, attains Salokya, not other worlds, by uttering my name. So the Muktika Upanishad is a very interesting Upanishad. It's a dialogue between Lord Rama and Hanuman. So Hanuman inquires about the types of moksha, and Lord Rama is answering the question. So here, Lord Rama is saying, anyone, even though leading a wicked life, attains Salokya by uttering my name. So what does that mean? So here the word Salokya literally means entering into a sphere called heaven or Swarga. So the first type of moksha or the first type of freedom that we can talk about is going into a place after death, obviously, where you are always happy. And you can simply attain this by just uttering the name of God. So this is the simplest way to go into heaven in that sense. So this becomes the first type of mukti. Basically, anyone who goes into heaven. So if someone tells you the goal of Hinduism, goal of Sanatana Dharma is to enter heaven, they are not wrong actually. Can you see that? It is not wrong because it is there in the Shastra. But whether you resonate with it depends on your disposition. Right? Can you see that? It depends on your disposition. We are not here to dispute that. It depends on who you are and what karmas you bring that determines whether you find this attractive. So an example of this that I'm going to share with you is like this one. So Salokya is like going to a vacation to another country where you're having a good time. Okay, so that's Salokya. So you go into a very nice space called Swarga where there is Ananda, there is happiness. It's like going to a vacation to another country. You go there, you look at this nice blue ocean and you feel so good. Right? So that is how the first type of mukti is. Now let's look at the second type, which is called Sarupya. Now Sarupya here you can see, etc. But what I take a few seconds to read this before I focus on a couple of things. So here, regardless of what is the means, but here you get a special mantra. So that means it's beyond uttering the Lord's name. like you get something very special called the Taraka Mantra. And then you will get my form. Now, this is the key point. He gets my form. So the Sarupya Mukti means you take on the form of the Devata that you are worshipping. You take on the form. It's not that you replace that person. You start getting those particular attributes of the Devata that you are worshipping. So that is called Sarupya. That's why it's called Sarupya, Rupa. Rupa means form. All right, so you take on the form of your Ishta Devata. So you look at that. There is also an ancient school in the Sanatana Dharma that also subscribe to this as well. So this is one type of mukti. So an example of this is this one. Can you see? So many supermen, but different actors. But all of them are supermen. Am I right? So it is like taking on the form of another person. See, each one of them, you can see in this picture, the many faces. The only superman that I watched in my generation was Christopher Reeves. All right, so that is, so you know what is my age by now. Okay, so basically taking on the form of the person that you adore, of the Devata or Ishvara that you see in a particular rupa. So that is called Sarupya. It is totally valid in Sanatana Dharma as well. And then the third one is called Samipya. Now Samipya is, the key point here is good conduct, with mind fixed upon me, loving me as the self of all, the twice born. Here the twice born refers to three varnas. Those of you who are familiar with the varnas, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya. Why? Because the twice born are people who have access to the Veda. That's what it means. That means they have learned about the knowledge of the Veda. Does not exclusively or only refer to the varna. It reflects the wisdom that they carry. They get nearer to me. So the key word here is nearer to me. You get it now? So it's like this, you know, some of us, you know, when we meet our CEO and then you stand next to your CEO, you have a conversation. And then for 2 weeks, we talk about the episode. You know, I got to speak to the CEO, you know, I met the prime minister, you know, I took a photo and it's on Instagram, right? So this is exactly what it is. So there is a value when you get closer to God, because you are now are so close to him. Maybe you are even, having a personal conversation with him, of course, in Swarga, in heaven. So how do you explain this? So this is how you explain this, right? So you take a photo, this person right next to Michael Jackson, and that's it, right? I took a photo with Michael Jackson. So what does it mean? Now, please pardon me. I'm not showing these photos to belittle any of these types of mukti. I'm giving you modern examples so that we can relate to what this ancient texts are actually telling us, all right? So it's like being close to someone inaccessible. So this is the key point. The key word is close and someone inaccessible. In this case, it's Ishvara or our Ishta Devata or any kind of Devata that we worship. So that is called Samipya, the third type of mukti. The fourth type of mukti is Sayujya. Now, Sayujya literally means this one. Okay, so take a few seconds to read this. So here is a very nice example. It says insects changing into the bee, something of that sort. So it's a transformation or what we call as liberation of identity. Or sometimes I call this merging. All right, merging into something that such that you lose your earlier form. So you get the point? So that means you merge into God. So let's say I pray to Lord Vishnu. That means I merge into Lord Vishnu and I lose my form. All right, so that is called Sayujya. So a good example to explain Sayujya is like this. When you put sugar into water, it dissolves. Can you see that? You don't see it anymore. It loses its earlier form. So this is the fourth type of mukti, Sayujya. So a lot of yoga traditions sometimes tend to move towards Sayujya at times. And also a lot of theistic traditions, bhakti traditions also subscribe to Sayujya. There are a lot of bhakti saints that are depicted in our Shastra where they actually merge and disappear, you know, in the sanctum of a temple and stuff like that. All right, so this is a depiction. So now comes the fifth type of mukti. So Kaivalya. Now listen, look at this particular statement from the Muktika Upanishad. Interesting, right? So it now creates a contrast. So for obvious reasons, because the Muktika Upanishad is trying to say that although there are four kinds of liberation that we just saw, which is starting from Salokya, Sarupya, Samipya, Sayujya, now Kaivalya. So what the Muktika Upanishad is saying, actually, The only real type of mukti is kaivalya. So this is a twist, right? So all are valid, but one somehow is the most, supposedly the most supreme. So this kaivalya mukti that we are talking about is something very interesting. So we have looked at all the illustrations. So in kaivalya mukti, what we are trying to see is this. Now look at this wave in the ocean. But kaivalya is like knowing wave to be water. It's very interesting, right? Even when the wave is a wave, it is still water. Even when the water takes on a form of the wave, it doesn't lose its nature of it being water. So therefore, this kaivalya is actually purely gained through knowledge, which is a very key point that we need to see. Sayujya, the means is actually meditation, dhyana, right? We saw in Sayujya. But in kaivalya, even meditation is not the means, which we will talk about a little later. All right, meditation cannot be the means to actually attain kaivalya. And this is the mukti that is taught through the Upanishads by Adi Shankara. So Adi Shankara presents this definition of kaivalya, of course, through his own ways. He does not use the word kaivalya as we possibly were expecting, but he describes it. So whenever I use the word mukti, or whenever I use the word moksha, I am referring to kaivalya. So I would like to request all of you to just, in the back of your minds, now recognize or identify kaivalya mukti whenever I use the word mukti and moksha from this point onwards. All right, so please keep that in your mind. So now let us describe or define what moksha is. So again, I'm now going to define kaivalya alone from this point onwards. So at this point, I want to use a very beautiful verse that Shankara presents in his Brahma Sutra Bhashyam. All right, it's a commentary on the Brahma Sutra. So, at many parts, Adi Shankara has written many commentaries. And then at certain points, he all of a sudden, presents something very beautifully. Not that other things are not beautiful, all right? But just this particular verse, it is very descriptive in that sense. So that's why I'm using the word beautiful. So here is how he defines and describes moksha. Here it is. So take a couple of seconds to read it. So the key takeaways from that verse is, number one, moksha is seeing the self or Brahman. That's the key point. Because we will see that a little later, what the self, which is called Atman. Some of you may be familiar with this word, Atman or Atma, basically means the self. So moksha is seeing the self, which is myself, my true nature, or Brahman, which is God or Ishvara, as the supreme reality. So that Sanskrit word is called Paramarthikam. All right, Shankara uses the word Paramarthikam. It's a supreme reality. This is the absolute reality. That's what it means. And then the second term he uses is, it is eternal and changeless. Kutastha Nityam. This is the word he uses. So it is eternal and it is changeless. That's the meaning of Kutastha and then Nityam. Kutastha means that which doesn't change. All right, it's always constant. That's what it means. Kutastha. And then, all-pervasive, vyomavat sarvavyapi. Vyomavat means like space. Vyoma means space. So like space, it is all-pervasive. Very beautiful, right? Each of these words, can you see that? Right? So it describes. And then, free from all modifications, sarva vikriya rahitam. It means it does not change and it does not have any kind of modifications. Or rather, it cannot be modified. That's what it means. So, Nitya Triptam, always contented, right? Beautiful, right? It is always contented, which means acceptance. It is able to accept and always contented, not looking for some new experience, etc. Without parts, Niravayavam, it does not have any parts. It is partless. Self-effulgent, Swayam Jyotis Swabhavam. That means, this self-effulgent means, a good way to look at it is, now, does a sun need a torchlight to reveal itself? A sun shines on its own, right? So here means, if you, in moksha state, you shine by yourself. The self or Brahman shines by itself. It does not need an external light to reveal it. That's what it means. And then, here, very nice word, not subject to dharmika or adharmika actions. Very important. That means any kind of action that you do in your life, any kind of karma, will not affect this self or Brahman. It is not affected by karma or even akarma or adharma, that means wrong actions. And very important point, you look at this word, kalatrayam, keyword, that means it's and its results. Karyena kalatrayam, he says, in the three periods of time. So neither action can affect the Brahman or affect the self or its results. In all the three periods of time, in the past it cannot affect, in the present it cannot affect, in the future too it cannot affect. So that means it is totally what I call not affected by actions and its results, which is basically papa, punya, etc. All of that does not affect. Even your karma does not affect. And lastly, beautiful word, bodiless. Ashariratvam, very key point. Now, when we say ashariratvam, what we are trying to say is this state of moksha is bodiless. So what does that mean? Now, he uses this word last. And there's a reason why he uses ashariratvam last. Because whatever that you are saying on the top, you can look at all the way from the top, paramarthikam, all the way till the last point, is actually not, does not refer to a body. Can you see that? That means if you see yourself as a body, you cannot look at yourself as a supreme reality. You cannot look at yourself as eternal or changeless because the body changes. The body is non-eternal. Can you see that? The body is not all-pervasive. The body is always going through modifications. We are always not contented. And we have several parts. So if someone cuts off my hand, I can still live. Can you see that? So we have parts. And then we are not self-effulgent, right? Because when we go to sleep, we don't see anything. Sometimes in the dark, we need a light, all right? So we are definitely not self-effulgent. And then we are bound by dharma and adharma. Can you see that? And then we are subject to past, present, and future, which is very simple. Our past are filled with pleasant memories or regrets and remorse. Our future is filled with anxiety or plans. Our present, some of us don't even know that we are in the present because our minds are oscillating between past and the future. So these three periods of time are subject to the body. So therefore, he concludes in the last statement. It is actually being ashariratvam. So we will talk about this ashariratvam a little extensively in a while. So this actually helps us to see what is it that moksha is. So if you were to attain moksha, this is your state. Can you see that? So now the problem is this. If I were to tell you that, you know what, when you attain moksha or mukti, you won't have a body. If you feel scared about this whole idea, very high chance you're not ready for it. Can you see that? Because you know why? The fear of losing this body or being bodiless means that we are actually losing something which we are valuing. So because we have this value for the things that we are going to lose at the expense of losing the body, therefore, from the perspective of Shankara, that means it is not moksha, you are not ready for it. So this readiness, we will look at it a little later. This is a hint, but please pardon me, I cannot make that conclusion because when you explore this knowledge a little more, maybe you will lose that fear. We cannot discount that. Because, you know, our karmas and Ishvara works in very mysterious ways sometimes. All right. So, you know, this whole readiness can happen. All right. Even not at this point, maybe in a future time or maybe in a future birth. There's no hurry, actually. All right. So key point. So here, the key that you've seen, the description that you find, you don't find this statement in many other places of his commentary. But here it's a very nice description and very summative in that sense. All right. That Shankara gives. And then now let's look at a few other things, perspectives of mukti. So this particular mukti that we just spoke about, that Adi Shankara just shared, there are various perspectives that we can take. And these perspectives are basically a couple of terms that are used in the Shastra. Jivan mukti, some of you would have heard this word, jivan mukti. Satyo mukti is another one that is very, very familiar, not very popular, satyo mukti. Krama mukti, and then videha mukti. So these are basically four perspectives of that one mukti. Now, I want to be very clear here. It is not that there are four different types of mukti. Now, if you look at a mountain, you can look at it from the north direction, you can look at it from the west direction, from the east and from the south. And the mountain will actually give a very unique perspective to you, but it's the same mountain. So four people can be looking at the same mountain from four different directions, but actually it is one mountain. So these four types of mukti, perspectives of mukti rather, is actually looking at this mukti, moksha, from four different perspectives. That's all. But it's all the same. So what are these? Let's look at it right now. So let's look at Jivan Mukti and Sadhya Mukti together because they are very related. So Jivan Mukti literally means liberated while living. That means Jivan Mukti literally means once you attain this moksha, what this perspective is that when you attain this moksha or mukti, you don't die immediately, actually. You are still living, but you are liberated. So that's the meaning of liberated while living. So I'll put there, while she lives in the world, she remains unaffected by it. So here the word she refers to a mukta. A mukta means a person who has attained mukti is called mukta. All right. So while she lives in the world, she remains unaffected by it. So that's one experience. That's why the person is liberated while living and does not cease to act, although these actions have no bearing on him. So if it's the word him here refers to mukta as well. All right. So what we are saying is the Jivan Mukta, a person who has attained Jivan Mukti is called Jivan Mukta. So the Jivan Mukta, although he or she lives in the world, he or she is not affected by the world. Number one. Number two, he or she would still act in the world, but it doesn't affect him or her. So that's the key point of Jivan Mukti. Now, what is Sadhya Mukti? Why do I put it together? Because it's actually a synonym, because it's very related, but there's a key difference. The word sadhya, the word sadhya mukti, the earlier word sadhya, the word that is connected to mukti, refers to the immediacy. That means immediacy means the moment someone teaches you about this Brahman, you gain this knowledge immediately. It is not you gain tomorrow. It is not that you gain a few years later. When you are ready, that mukti takes place in the present moment. So that immediacy, that's how the key word here is immediacy, is represented by the word sadhya. So that's why it's immediate. That means the power of this knowledge, the liberating power, is actually because it can liberate you immediately in the present. So sometimes you're listening to a teacher, and then at a particular point in time, it just clicks. All right. So when that clicks at that particular point in time, now that particular perspective is called sadhya mukti. That perspective, because it has the capacity and the ability to make you free actually immediately. You would have realized this if you have studied this from any teacher. Some of you who may have attended classes on moksha or Vedanta or Advaita Vedanta, you realize that whenever the teacher teaches you, at a particular point of time, there's a light bulb in your head. You know, suddenly it lights up, right? You feel that, you know, it's very clear to me. Now it's something like that. But this light bulb, it keeps becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. Finally, it just consumes you. And that means Jivan. And it happens immediately. So that's why it's called Sadhya Mukti. Then let's go to the other perspective, which is called Videha Mukti. The word Videha Mukti means without body. The Mukti without body. So Vi and Deha means without body. So Mukti. What is without body Mukti? So it is basically the whole concept of casting off the body of a Mukta at the time of death. So there are two schools of thought in Videha Mukti. One school of thought is that although the person is a Jivan Mukta, but at a particular point in time, the person will drop the body because the body falls off because something called Prarabdha Karma, which we'll talk about later. So in that particular point, they say that he discards his body and merges with Brahman. All right, so that is the view. They say that at that point in time, when the karma gets exhausted, the Jivan Mukta will drop off the body and merge with Brahman. That is also, the third point, which I just mentioned, it happens after the exhaustion of the Prarabdha Karma. I'll talk about Prarabdha Karma a little later. Because Prarabdha Karma means even after gaining mukti, there is some karma that is still left that needs to be exhausted. All right. So this particular Prarabdha Karma is basically that karma that is left behind to actually stay there till the Jivan Mukta drops off. So people ask this question sometimes. Why does a Mukta has Prarabdha Karma? You know why? Very simple answer. If the Mukta does not have a Prarabdha Karma, he cannot make another Mukta. Can you get it? Because he still has to teach. She still has to teach. So the person who has gained this Mukti also can make another person a Mukta. So therefore, this Prarabdha Karma is the allowance of Ishvara so that he or she, after gaining the knowledge, can now liberate others. If not, there is no window period to liberate others, to share with others. It's impossible. So there is one explanation given. Although there is another technical explanation, which we will possibly talk in another class. So another interpretation is, now this is the second perspective of this Videha Mukti, is that Jivan Mukti and Videha Mukti is actually the same. So what this here means that the moment you attain Jivan Mukti, you lose your identification with the body. So it is not literally the body dropping off, dying. Can you see that? So Videha Mukti's second meaning is the body doesn't drop off actually. All right, but you lose your identification with the body. Although the body is there, but you lose the identification. So let me give an example of this. Now, sometimes you watch a TV series, all right, on Netflix or any other, you know, you watch TV series. Now, then you're watching multiple series, a long, series, many seasons. And then in one of the seasons, a character appears called John. All right, so after in the second season, John dies. All right, John is dead. The funeral is done, John is dead. And then in your mind, you know John is dead. And then in the third season, John appears again. But you know why? The series is now showing the prequel, what happened before. But in your mind, you know John is dead. Although you're watching John in the series, in the episode, but in your mind, you know actually in the second season, John died. So he's just making an appearance in the past. But in your mind, you know John is dead. So John is alive from one standpoint because he's appearing in the TV episode. But in your mind, you know John is dead. Actually, it's not happening in the present. Can you see that? The same thing happens in the case of Videha Mukti. Although the Jivan Mukta has a body, but in the past, it's over, it's gone. Can you see that? Although it is still operating, but it is not there. So that is the whole, the way you look at being, not having a body while attaining Mukti. Then the last one is called Krama Mukti. All right, Krama Mukti. Krama Mukti is basically what we call as gradual liberation. Now, what is gradual liberation? So sometimes some people who attain this Vedanta knowledge, you realize that although you are learning Vedanta or learning about Brahman or yourself, but you don't attain the Mukti immediately, but you have put a lot of effort. So what happens to such a person? So such a person goes to a heaven called Brahmaloka. That's what the Shastra says, goes to Brahmaloka. And then the person doesn't return back to this life, doesn't get born again. But that person remains in Brahmaloka and then learn from Lord Brahma. Now, Lord Brahma will teach the person this Vedanta. And he once, he, you know, until Samyak Jnana, that means Samyak Jnana here means clear knowledge. Until the clear knowledge about the self and Brahman is attained. And then at the end of the Kalpa, which is the dissolution of the world creation, he attains Mukti or Moksha. So this is actually specially for people who have done a lot of sadhana, means spiritual practices, and attained this particular, done a lot of sadhanas and attained, rather learning this knowledge, very advanced, but have not attained Mukti. So they will go to Brahmaloka and stay there until the dissolution of the Kalpa. That's the whole idea. So these are basically the perspectives of Krama Mukti. So you can see Sajivas will not be born again, and also it is very relevant for people who worship Saguna Brahman. See, the word Saguna Brahman means God or Ishwara with a form. Saguna means with attributes. So when you worship Ishwara in a form, like which has what I call Nama and a Rupa, a name and a form. When you worship Ishwara with that particular, what I call vision, then such a person may go to Brahmaloka and then gain that knowledge there. That's what the Shastra says. And then now, myths and misconceptions, last one for today, last copy. So let me share with you that there's a couple of myths and misconceptions of moksha, which we will talk more about that in future classes. The first one is, if I attain moksha, I will become happy. Now, that's a misconception. If you're looking for happiness in moksha, you've come to the wrong place. Because you know why? Your happiness is usually dependent on an object. Think about it. Think about all the times that you've been happy. There is always some change that is happening. From the time that you were a kid till now, it is always some change that is creating happiness. So if you think that moksha is another change, you got it wrong. In fact, samsara is getting tired of the change. Can you see that? So actually, the way to look at it is, if you're tired of becoming happy, tired of seeking happiness, then perhaps you're in the right place. So this is the first misconception. If you're looking for happiness, you need to investigate a little more. Go deeper. We need to do the, we'll do this inquiry a little later. If I attain moksha, I will become successful. Also not true. Will you become a failure? Also not true. Because your success and failure depends on your skills and lack of skills. It has got nothing to do with Brahman. So I know there are sometimes there are many academies or very many institutions that use Vedanta as a means to motivate oneself. It's interesting, isn't it? But actually, it is. If you want to get motivated, go and attend some talks of the motivational gurus, motivational speakers. They will motivate you because motivation is not true. Okay, if you look at the bottle half empty, the motivational speaker will make you look at it half full. That's all. But the bottle doesn't change. So basically, moksha is not to become successful. You can't become successful. Listen very carefully. You may become successful. You may fail. But it is not because of the knowledge. It is because also of your skills that you become successful or you become a failure. Moksha is the goal for everyone. It's also a misconception. Because we saw that samsara earlier. Now, change is always not a problem. Can you see that for some people? But for some people, change is a problem. So therefore, we cannot say moksha is the goal for everyone, which we'll again talk about in a future class. And then moksha is only for a sannyasi. So I'm not able to see all of your pictures at this point in time. But this is also a misconception. Moksha is not for a sannyasi alone, but a sannyasi is much better prepared for moksha than perhaps a person who is not a sannyasi. But that doesn't disqualify you from attaining moksha because it's entirely dependent on your competence, which is regardless of whether you're a sannyasi or not. All right, so this is how you look at it. So with that, now let's conclude. All right, there are many terms of moksha that we saw. We also saw the five types of moksha or mukti. We saw that the only one presented as Kaivalya is the ultimate, and Kaivalya is the knowledge of the self or Brahman that we saw. And then Kaivalya Mukti can be looked at from several perspectives. We saw that, the different types of Videha Mukti, Sadhya Mukti, Jivan Mukti, Krama Mukti. And then the last point is there are also many myths and misconceptions surrounding moksha.